We're starting a new series today, and I don't know, we'll go for a while, and it's called Simple Conspiracy, Fight Back. Look, conspiracy, that has become a big word in our culture these days. There are some who are massive conspiracy theorists on anything of what's going on. The idea of a conspiracy is, for the most part, pretty negative. Okay, if you were to look up the definition of a conspiracy, it means people who gather together to do something illegal or harmful to somebody else. This is the name of our series. Okay, I don't want you to miss this. The heart of the idea of a conspiracy is the fact that we team up with others. You can't have a conspiracy of one. It doesn't work that way. You have to have a bunch. You have to have a group of people together. And so the idea of a conspiracy is that people get together and devise some kind of a scheme to bring something down. Okay? The most popular way that we hear the word conspiracy is about bringing down the government. You know, there's a conspiracy to bring down the government. Well, we're not here to bring down the government. Okay? That is left for others to do. You are probably most familiar with the word conspiracy right now, as it is connected to what we just went through right before Christmas. We called it Advent conspiracy. And the word conspiracy would make sense if you apply it to what we just did. Our desire in Advent conspiracy is to bring down the way that Christmas is done and to restore it back to the story of Jesus and the priorities of the kingdom. It is to chip away at the things that have made Christmas wrong and to grab hold of what is right, which is to do good, which is to share what we have, which is to give away and to say enough is enough. I'm telling you, ask your children about how they really feel about Advent conspiracy. Now, there are some of them that have been along for the ride enough that they know, yep, love Advent conspiracy. I don't get as many presents. But that is not the loud vocal chirp of most children at North Point. They have to learn. They have to learn along the way, because this is a conspiracy that's going to cut in to their Christmas gift getting. If it's done well. You see, we're trying to bring it down. A simple conspiracy, from our point of view, is us joining together to challenge the values and structures of this world. Followers of Jesus, honestly, have always been subversive. Always. You know how I know that? They have always gotten killed for their faith. We are one of the lone places on the planet where we are not getting killed because of our faith. It may be happening in some small places, but around the world it happens with great regularity to those who stand up and proclaim the name of Jesus. It is, in some cultures, a sure fire way of losing your life or being tortured. Now, we have always been a subversive lot. That is our heritage. Those are our people. They're gathered around the globe today, many of them huddled in safe places in order to avoid martyrdom, in order to avoid being persecuted for their faith. The people of God have always been countercultural. It's our nature. It's who we are. We follow a leader who flew in the face of the Roman government of his day. You do remember what happened to our leader, don't you? Yeah. You see, we're part of a counterculture, a movement that challenges those things that everybody else says are normal. And we go, nah, not so fast. Not so normal. So we're going to look at some things. We're going to look at familiar topics. But I want to challenge you to look at them from a counterculture point of view, a subversive point of view. I want you to join a conspiracy that flies in the face of what others say is normal. Take on a new normal. The life of Jesus. I've realized through the years, and we've had this conversation, many of us have had it one-on-one, and I know I've talked about it here many times through the years. My upbringing, my personal upbringing, was a little unusual by comparison to most. Not only am I an only child, but I have no relationships with aunts, uncles, cousins. I never did. The few that I had lived completely in completely different parts of the country. My father was a carpenter who we never vacationed because my dad was always subject to work and needing to take it when he could get it. And so I had one family vacation my whole life growing up in my sixth grade year. Other than that, we never vacationed. We didn't go and see family. Family reunions for the Farah household was simply dinner after church on Sundays. That was about what family reunion was. I only met one grandparent of mine and had virtually no real relationship with her. Saw her a few times. Lived halfway across the country. It was just kind of me and my parents. And when Wanda and I, my wife and I, got married, I inherited a family, her family, that was it was a little larger than mine, but it was quite a bit more dysfunctional than mine was. I just didn't have enough people in my family to be dysfunctional. She had enough. And one of the things that we did in our early years of dating and our early years of marriage is that we had to put up boundaries. We absolutely had to put up boundaries because of the unhealthiness that was on her side of the family. And so we are these little vagabond children, Wanda and I have been, our whole lives, kind of wandering around. And what happened to us is that the church became our family. It became our family. And it became our family in such a way that there was no competition with our blood family. We never had the dilemmas that all of you have when it came to Christmas, when it came to holidays, when it came to going and, you know how your family kind of dictates to you what you need to do? We never had those competitions. Now, on the other hand, we never had the great joy that many of you have of experiencing life with your extended family. It was really funny when my oldest son, he married into a large, large extended family that all live in all kinds of places. And I remember the first time he had to go to a family reunion in Nebraska. And he called me on the phone and said, "What is up with this? Why didn't you prepare me for this? This is the most ridiculous thing I have ever been part of." You know, my antisocial son became exponentially more antisocial. You know, just, you know, trying to get away from all of these people. He didn't know how to handle it. Now, I'm telling you that story to tell you that I recognize the dilemma that I have today saying some things to you. Because the things I'm going to say to you today are really easy for me to say. They are not as easy for you to hear or to juggle in some way or the other. In the book of Galatians, as well as the book of Hebrews, we see these words written by the authors. Galatians, Paul wrote, "Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers." The author of Hebrews said this, he even more succinctly, "Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters." No matter how you cut it, no matter how complicated your family dynamic is, no matter how great or bad your family dynamic is, you cannot escape from the truth of these words, and that is we are to have a special relationship with each other. For me, you all, for the last 23 years, have been my best friends. You are my best friends and my closest allies. Many of you are the people that I have confided in. If I haven't confided in you, it's just because we're not close enough yet. If you know me well enough, I'll spill the beans on anything in my life to just about anybody I'm having a Coke with. All right? You have become my best friends. And you may go, "Well, I don't feel like your best friend." Well, give it time, work a little harder. I'll grow on you, and I'll become your stalker, okay? There are many of you that feel that way about me because I pop up in all sorts of places. We are to be able to call each other family. And you go, "Well, I already have a family." Yeah, you've got that family. But you have this family also. We are called in Scripture brother and sister. Some of you grew up in churches where they would say, "Oh, here's Brother Farah." In fact, every now and then we have visitors who come to North Point and they refer to me as that. "Oh, you're Brother Farah, huh?" Yeah, if we have to, you know, or sister so-and-so. Growing up in my home church, that's how they were all referred to. This sister so-and-so, she's been teaching Sunday school for 87 years, or whoever. I don't know if you've ever had that experience in a church where they refer to people that way, but it's kind of cute. But it's kind of biblical, too. Feels old-fashioned. Feels pretty Amish to me. But it's still reality. You know, there are symbols of religion. There are for any religious group. If I tell you, now be careful, you don't have to say anything, but if I tell you white shirt and a tie, most all of you have an image that went right across your forehead. If I said somebody is wearing a veil across their face, a female is wearing a veil across their face, you've got a pretty good image of who that would be and what religious group that is. I don't see it much here, back in my homeland. If you saw a dude walking around in a white robe with a ponytail cut into the back of his head but bald on the rest of it, you knew for sure what religious group they were with. Many of you guys go to high school and you will often see somebody that has a little red dot right there. We know what religious group that is. There are religious symbols. We have our own out of our heritage. Maybe not exactly our own, but certainly the lineage of people who have followed Christ. If you watch somebody who is holding on to a what looks like a necklace full of beads and rubbing them. You have a pretty good idea which part of the church they are from. If you see somebody driving around with an image of a fish on the back of their car, first off, tell them to slow down. They're not representing themselves, okay? And to obey the rules, okay? But that has historically been an image of somebody that is a follower of Christ. There are many people in this church family, because I've visited your homes, and you have collections of crosses at your house. The cross has historically been a representation of Christianity and of Jesus, who was put to death on the cross. Do you have a co-worker who comes to work carrying a 4-inch Bible and lays it on their desk? That's an image. The Bible, on the other hand, gives us what I believe to be a real image or mark of one who claims to be a follower of Christ. This idea does not originate with me. It originated years and years ago, but it made an impact on my life to the point that I believe this with my whole heart. It's out of John, the Gospel of John, chapter 13. Here's this passage. This is Jesus talking. He says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." The real mark is not a cross hanging around your neck or an image of a fish on the back of your car. The mark of a follower of Christ out of the mouth of Jesus is the way we love. It's the distinguishing feature of one who claims to be a follower of His. Now, make no mistake, we are called to love everybody. Jesus is really clear on this. There is no mistaking it. Jesus even says that we are to love our enemies as if they were our brothers. That's how strong this love we are to have is to be. And it's disappointing. It's beyond disappointing. It is, to me, shattering that the church these days is so, so very guilty of being the ones who are the judges and juries of people. And that our reputation is of one of intolerance. Now, I know that's not a popular word among Christian people, but it's still a word that needs to be reckoned with. That is what we are often known for, as being intolerant of other people. The great command of the Bible makes no distinction. We are to love God with our entire heart, mind, soul, spirit, everything that we are. And the definition of that love is that we are to love others as we love ourselves and as we have been loved by God. No distinction, no lines, no parameters. We love others. The story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible makes it abundantly clear. We love others simply because they are made in the image of our Creator. They need no other reason to be recipients of our love other than to be human. It's the greatest of all laws. People are to be loved at all cost. Have you heard this line? It's pretty popular these days. We are to love the sinner but hate the sin. Can I just give you a little bit of encouragement? Is not to say that anymore. It doesn't need to be said. How about if we just become people that say love? And we'll leave the rest to God. But if we are to love everybody, and I understand there are complications and difficulties with loving people, trust me. If we are to love everybody according to God's Word, how much more important and profound to see us love each other. If we can't, or if we don't love here, how will we ever be believed out there? How are we to love each other? Look, I'm not going to go. This is elementary church to talk about what love looks like. We are to love the way that Jesus loved. Period. And I recognize that it's a tall order. We are just mere humans with all of our imperfections and how difficult it is to love people that are not like us. Think how difficult it would be to love you if they really knew you. But we are to love the way that Jesus loved us. But here's the deal in this passage. And this is something that defines our relationships with each other. Jesus gives people in our world, especially people who are far from Him, people who are not believers, Jesus gives the people in our world the right to judge whether you and I are Christians. And you know that line? We love using this. Don't judge me. You said that this week? You know, some behavior you had? People around you giving you the look? You go, don't judge me. Well, here's the place that you cannot say that. You are not allowed to say that, according to the Bible, to anybody that does not claim to be a follower of Christ. You can't say it to them. You cannot say to them, don't judge me. Because Jesus says, they get to judge you. They do. And they get to judge us simply on whether or not we love each other. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. The standard by which you get to be judged and I get to be judged by all of those who do not know Christ is whether we love each other. Are you feeling the pressure? You go, that's not fair. God isn't fair sometimes. Yeah, it's unfair and it's frightening to know that people have the right to do that. But it's their prerogative given by Jesus Himself. Gosh, no wonder. No wonder people have such a big problem with church these days. But they get to judge. They get to conclude that the way we treat each other matters. And frankly, it's given the world a whole lot to shake their heads about. There's even more to this one. Okay, Jesus says it a few chapters later in the book of John. This is what He writes. This is what is written. Jesus is talking to His disciples right now. He says, my prayer is not for them alone. Meaning, He distinguished in this prayer that He gave. And you can read all of chapter 17 of John. But He distinguished in this prayer that there were certain parts of this prayer that were given specifically for the disciples, the 12 that were with Him. And then He sort of makes a break in this prayer and says, now I'm going to pray for somebody else. He goes, my prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. Meaning, He's praying now for all of the people historically who are going to come to faith as a result of the discipleship and as a result of the obedience of the disciples to pass on the message of Jesus over the next 2,000 years. This prayer that Jesus is going to give right now, Jesus is praying 2,000 years ago for you and me. It's very specific prayer. This is how it continues. I pray that all of them, we are the them now, all of them may be one, Father, just as You are in me and I am in You. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that You have sent me. Wow. This love of brothers and sisters is not self-serving. It is more profound than that. If I don't love other believers the way that Jesus loves me, not only can people who are far from God conclude that I'm probably not a Christian, they can also conclude that God is not who He says He is. And His Word cannot be trusted, since they don't see us being one in unity and love and commitment. That is how profound our relationship with each other is. We need to have good answers to difficult questions when we are asked. But the final and best defense of the reality of God has always been the love that believers have for each other. There was always something special between them. We have the power of God inside of us, and it is to exhibit itself in our relationship. Shouldn't there be a difference in the way that we treat each other? Shouldn't there be? What's this love supposed to look like? Well, I'll tell you this. It's not a feeling. It's an act of the will. Love isn't pretty. You don't always feel like loving others. Anyone raise a hand to that one? Doesn't always feel good. But love is an intentional movement. It's to act in the best interest of another person. These relationships in this room. Now, this message could go to any church at any point in time. It extends out beyond these walls to people who are part of this church family and beyond. I get it. This is about all Christians loving each other. But for today, it is about us. Okay? It's just about us today. These relationships in here matter. How we treat each other is the foundation for how we will treat all other people. Forgiving each other, encouraging each other, literally spending time with each other. Look, you can't have a relationship of family if you don't spend time with each other, at least sometime. It's got to be done. Speaking the truth to each other, praying for each other, serving each other, giving to each other, sharing joy and sorrow together, other than a wedding and a funeral. That's how we are to live with each other. There is to be such a noticeable display of love between us that those who are far from God can conclude that we are Christians and can conclude that God is a keeper of His Word simply by looking at us. At our oneness and our love will be compelling evidence that there is a God and His words can be trusted. And all I can say is, what an amazing opportunity to participate in God's plan. Doesn't take a degree. Just takes being one of His followers. These are good times here at North Point these days. Things have changed a lot in the last few months. I mean, a lot. I realize that. But even in the midst of all of the change that we have experienced, there is an incredible oneness, spirit of cooperation on so many things. I hope that many of you are participating in some kind of group of people where you are experiencing that kind of relationship building and unity. There are some incredibly deep and profound relationships that exist here. But if you are not connected, if you are not connected past coming and sitting here on a Sunday morning, I'm just going to say it, you're missing the point. And you're also missing the joy and the meaning and the purpose of this whole experience. The challenge is for you to get connected. There are ways to do it. Nobody can ever say anymore, well, we didn't know about that. It's all out there. There are ways. In fact, all you got to do is on your way out today, just stop somebody and go, hey, I think I'd like to get connected a little deeper. Who do I need to talk to? And it'll happen. It will happen. We are a group of people, a band can come up. We're a group of people that share communion every Sunday together. It's part of our fellowship and it's part of our theology. It's part of our practice. And I guess I want to remind you that communion, by its very definition, is the word community. That's where we get it. The words are connected. Community, communion. It is done together. When the juice and the bread are passed in front of you, don't draw inward. Don't draw inward. Begin to let that flow outward for you. Communion is done with this group of people. Life is shared with this group of people. When we take the bread and we take the juice as it comes by, you can take it and hold it there for a while, or you can take it right on the spot. I made a joke to the band today, and I said, you know, we did a communion thing last week if you were here. And one of the things that I said last week is that I wanted us to begin the practice of lingering a little longer in communion, at communion time. And so I said to the band today, no more speed dating with Jesus at communion time. This is not a race. This is not a, you don't just get through this and get on with the rest of your day, but take a moment and linger a little bit on remembering who He is and what He's done. And then take a little time and ponder the fact that you are part of this body of believers. You are part of this family. Are you connected? Did Jesus die on the cross for you to be isolated, or did He die on the cross for you to be part of family? And as family is expressed, the world gets to determine the validity of God based on our interaction with each other. I love that. I hope that you do too.